Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Deepest Lore. It's high tea. That means only one thing. It's time to talk about some aspect of culture or art. Now, Mark, last week, Mr. D was throwing a bit of shade, saying that him talking about modern art and defending at certain points literally turds in cans passed off as art drew almost 7,000 viewers, whereas our first show struggled to make it past 3,000. And the debate was it the subject matter, that is there not much demand for late 80s Batman comics, or was it the guest? What do you think, Mark?
Well, let me put it this way. When John, because I did tune into that modern art stream. So if John's going to argue that that there needs to be necessarily a barrier to entry for high art, then clearly simply the people who are watching Batman are more cultured and have a higher artistic merit than the people who wanted to listen to him talk his tripe about ruffled bed covers.
So what you're saying is he is the kind of populist plebeian, and this is the true elite, because there's such small amounts of people interested in it.
Exactly. Just that you require much more of a like a little bit of that little extra bit of pizzazz, that little bit of extra commitment. That
do you think if we can get the figures low enough, we could possibly apply for a government grant?
if we only have 100 viewers over the course of the stream, just be like, we know we've peaked. Art being the only medium where you can claim like a lower viewership as kind of a an accolade.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to get into this, but I may well be making a video later on about the fact that Ofcom received 24,000 plus complaints about this dance that went on.
Oh, the diversity rubbish.
Yeah, the diversity's dance interpretation of the unfortunate happenings in America.
In America, that's the insanity of it. Like, are they making were they making an international anyway?
And do you think Ofcom have this is the second most complained about event in television history. Do you think that they have actually responded to these complaints, or do you think they've sided with the dance group?
Do I think the establishment group sided with the establishment dance troupe? Yes, I think that there's no way that they're going to actually complain. Given that certain programs get pulled when they have, I think the threshold was something like 12 complaints, and now when they receive record levels, then that's their indication to push back, because clearly the plebeians need to be told.
It's just striking me more and more that the views of, going back to what we were talking about last week, the views of the plebeians simply doesn't matter. If the elites make up their mind that they're going to do something, they're going to do something, and it doesn't really matter to hell with what anybody thinks about it. They're just going to push ahead with this regardless.
Indeed.
So there we go.
I agree with what Mickey Rat in chat says, which is skipped the modern art rubbish, Batman ho.
Yes, so where were we? Well, last time on The Deepest Lore, we were discussing Batman from the late 1980s. We looked at the infamous run of Max, what's his name? Max Allan Collins?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Who kind of retold the Jason Todd origin story. And then we looked at the run of, who was it now? I can't remember. Was it Alan Moore? Was it who was on the second?
Alan Moore was on it. We're Jim Starlin and Aparo.
Yes, Starlin and Aparo's run, pretty much, which took us up to 1989. So we looked at that entire chunk of post-crisis on the main Batman title. Now, if you don't know that much about the Batman comics, There is, much like on this channel, how there is an A show, which is Unpopular Opinions, and a B show, which is the Cigar Stream. Batman has like an A comic and a B comic. And Batman's Cigar Stream, if you want to put it that way, is a book called Detective Comics. Still running today. It's had over 1,000 issues. One of the grand titles in all of comics. And it runs alongside. But I think you'd agree, Mark, that Batman is the A book and Detective Comics is the B book, right?
I've actually kind of come around on this. I've really enjoyed reading this particular run of Detective.
Yes. No, this is the thing. I, just as many people, prefer the Cigar Stream to Unpopular Opinions. It is possible that Detective Comics can actually be better than the main Batman book. But the fact of the matter is that it is still the B. It's still the B book, right? By which I mean, Batman's main book is Batman, and his second book is Detective Comics.
Yeah,
And this can be seen because one of the creative duos that we'll be looking at on today's show, which is Alan Grant and Norm Brayfogle. They have a very successful run on Detective Comics throughout this period, which we're going to start to look at today, but we don't actually get to the end of their run until next time. They basically get promoted, I believe, in about 1990, and then spend 2 years on the main Batman book. So Grant and Brayfogle move up to do Batman. And you see that a lot, that a creative team will come in, have a run on Detective Comics, and then, you know, they'll maybe Denny O'Neill will say, okay, go up to the main book now. And I don't think it happens the other way around very often.
No.
Unless there's some loose ends to tie up. I want to say maybe it happened in the year I want to say Greg Rucka, someone like that, maybe goes the other way at one point, but I don't think so. Okay, but anyway, before we get to Grant and Brayfogle, there is the curious run of Mike W. Barr.
Yep.
Mike Barr, a big name in comics in his own right. I think he's done, he's worked on other stuff other than Batman, as a lot of these people have. Let me just see what Mike Barr is best known for. He's worked on Marvel stuff. He's worked on Green Lantern, worked on Spider-Man, Justice League, written for Star Trek. he's been around the block, right? Here he has this curious little run on Detective Comics in late 1986, going into 1987. Just after the Crisis on Infinite Earths, and alongside Frank Miller's Year One. Now, he wrote something called Batman Year Two, which we're not covering today because it's not collected in these books, and also because I'm avoiding anything to do with early Batman in this read through, as I explained before, but. Did you know that, Mark, that he wrote Batman Year 2?
No, I didn't. No.
Yeah, and Batman Year 2 is one of those stories that, one, is not thought of very highly within the kind of Batman community, and two, is kind of been retconned out of existence. So if you look for continuity reading guides online, most of them just fire Batman Year 2 out of the canon. It's been decanonized for some reason.
D would probably like it because it's cool to hate on it.
more shade thrown at John D. So with that said, why don't we get into this?
Well, of course, we have the first story of this run, which isn't actually a bar title. It's Cavalier and Jansen, I think.
So let me... pull this up. No, this is the wrong one. Can you see that, Mark?
I can't. Yes, I can now.
Okay. Do I need to make my screen bigger or something? So
no, you're all good there.
Maybe that helps. Okay.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Okay, so as we'll see, I don't know how many memos were given about exactly what was going on after the Crisis on Infinite Earths, but I think you'd agree that this whole little run is somewhere caught in between where the book was going and where it had been, and it's kind of all over the place. Any initial thoughts before we get into this? In terms of what the direction the book was trying to go in and what Mike Barr was actually up to here.
As I say, I don't think he does the first story, but there seems to be a bit more of a return to more comic booky oriented, although Batman's in a strange one where it's sort of halfway between kind of gritty noir and the kind of Marvel all sorts of colors all over the place. I mean, you can see with the costumes here that we've got the Rogues Gallery is coming back. We've got Catwoman and her cat of nine tails, because why wouldn't they? And we'll see slightly later on that a lot of the set design is kind of slightly more larger than life once again. But it's also got that kind of that campy, it's a bit campier, I would say, than the main one.
The adjective I'd describe it as is harking back to the Silver Age.
Yeah, I liked Jason Todd a lot more in this run than I did in the mainstay Batman comics. Yes.
Oh, here's this bloody Legends crossover again. Why do they bother including? They should have just been like, we're not going to include these. But anyway, yes, I forgot about this. So this is this Legends crossover. Written by, who's the writer on it?
Cavalieri.
Joey Cavalieri. So we don't have a bar to start off with, and it's a Penguin story. Is that right?
No. This is a Catwoman story, if I'm remembering correctly. With I'm on the wrong one. You're right. It is. It does start with the Penguin. One thing that you'll notice, this chap. What's the artist? Jansen has gone for a lot more of a low resolution imagery. So you'll notice that whilst the backgrounds are fairly detailed, the faces I hate the art direction. I think I was telling you this the other day when I was reading it through, and it took me ages. But thankfully, when Barr's run starts proper, either I've got used to the art direction, or it's just improved markedly.
There's Penguin. See, I knew he was around. Do you know how I knew it was Penguin story? Mm. Other than the fact I've read this, it was called Airy, and it was a bird reference. There's no way it's not a Penguin story.
I couldn't work out what it was bloody called. I spent about 5 minutes trying to read Empire. Is it, you know, that sort of thing? I couldn't do it. Oh yes, this is the story with the Peregrine Falcons. Grotesquely oversized Peregrine Falcons, isn't it?
Now this is an interesting little period for the Penguin, because he's kind of he's not yet running the iceberg lounge and hasn't really transitioned into being the kind of gangster Penguin that we get in the mid 90s, that, you know, he's more or less in that mode for over a decade. He's actually harking back to his roots here. He's just kind of like still knocking around doing bird-based capers, essentially.
He seems to have been used as a mainstay kind of villain of the week character, but one that clearly the fans and have enjoyed enough to keep him around longer than, say, the mime or something like that. But yeah,
in my mind, the Penguin is actually Batman's number two villain. But I think that's an old-fashioned view these days. I don't think fans at large typically think, well, it's Joker number one and then Penguin number two. I think that's, you know, somebody who grew up with the 1960s Adam West Batman, and when Batman Returns came out, you know, the Michael Keaton Batman was Joker first, and then the second villain was Penguin in Batman Returns. And I, to me, that made perfect sense because the Penguin was always the number two villain. But I think that since that time, would it be fair to say that his stock has, I'm going to say fallen, but it's kind of like, there's quite, it's quite contested who Batman's number two villain would be at this point.
Like he's underrated, as chat's saying, but I think it's hard to know what to do with his character. Much like the Riddler, for instance, has a really, really interesting origin story. But once you get past that, there's not a lot you can do with him. So,
well, I remember reading, because I was into the Batman the Animated Series, as I'm sure a lot of you were, and Paul Dini. Or Dini, I don't know how you say it, but I say Dini. He wrote very good. He's always written very good Riddler stories. Mm. But I remember an interview with him and some of the other writers saying, like, Riddler is a 200 IQ genius, and it's really hard to write somebody that clever because most writers aren't going to be as clever as him. So it's like, so there's a significant challenge of coming up with plots ingenious enough for the Riddler. On that point, the Riddler is entirely absent from this entire run. He wasn't in Batman, and he hasn't been in this run at all. Not a single Riddler story.
Not even a reference. No. When it comes to Batman's number two, like for me, it's always a toss up between Penguin, Bane. Interestingly, because Bane has kind of been neutered in recent years as well. They make him out to be much more of a bit of a like an idiot with an obsession than what he originally was, which was basically a bit of a criminal mastermind in his own right.
Well, I mean, if we do get to Nightfall doing this, Mark, and I'm confident that with the Batman film coming up, the audience figures will pick up for this eventually. Maybe. But even if they don't, what the hell, we're allowed to put our feet up and talk about Batman if we want, damn it.
Fireside chat.
Chat at high tea. I've got my Marks and Spencer's strong tea. But if we ever do get to Nightfall, frankly, he's OP. He's overpowered and is so it was obvious he would be kind of nerfed a little bit. So you've got toss up for Batman second villain. You've got Penguin, you've got Bane.
Yeah. You've got Poison Ivy is possibly in there. She started off as like a weak character, and now she's quite overpowered. So there's that. Generally gets paired up with another character, like Floronic Man or something like that. But it's
I'd stick Ra's al Ghul as a contender as well, because he's...
Instead of Ra's al Ghul, just the entire League of Shadows, because Ra's and Talia al Ghul obviously have big plays to make, but they're kind of chaotic evil in the sense that sometimes they're on side and sometimes they're not. So I don't know whether or not, as pure villainy goes, they could be up there.
I also think that we've seen during this era that the Joker, whenever there's a major plot point, it has to be Joker. So I really think it's during this era where the Joker starts to pull away. So it's just like, yeah, there's the Joker and then there's all the other villains as well. Whereas Penguin's clearly just like popping in here as, you know, two penny villain of the week, basically. So
that was one of the things I really disliked about a lot of the modern Joker stuff with regards to I was playing I've just played through Batman Arkham Asylum, which is a great game by Rocksteady, and they produced three sequels, well, two sequels and a prequel. One's Arkham City, Joker is the main villain in that. Then they made Arkham Origins, which was by a separate studio but a prequel, and it's Joker's the main villain in that, and you get really tired of just everything coming back and it's always the Joker. There's no, like, you get all the nice side missions and the appropriate cameos as you go through, but it was really refreshing to have kind of Ra's al Ghul turn up in City as kind of a primary antagonist as well. Hugo Strange, what do you make of Hugo Strange?
Well, he's in my mind, he's an early villain, isn't he? He's always associated with, you know, one of the first guys, supervillains that Batman goes up against. So,
I think for a supervillain to have contend with Batman to be his number two, he has to be significant enough to be beyond one good run.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, Two-Face is worth mentioning because of all Batman's villains, Batman has a special relationship because he kind of, you know, he knew Harvey Dent and sort of maybe even sometimes blames himself. The trouble with Two-Face is that he struggles to get past his origin story often. As we saw with that bloody awful Two-Face story last
time. Oh, God. We do have another Two-Face story coming up in this run. Yeah. But it's at least that one has a bit more. That's almost got Hush overtones, undertones even. But I hate Two-Face. I hate everything about his character, and I've never been a fan, and I don't know why. I can't get on board with anything. I think he's a terrible character. So
just to come back to Penguin very briefly, one of the things I think is interesting about him is that whereas a lot of the other Batman villains are kind of ciphers for Batman in some way, Penguin's the one character who is the cipher for Bruce Wayne. He's like the anti-Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
He's the anti-Bruce Wayne, and he's everything. He wants to be Bruce Wayne, essentially, but he's everything that Bruce Wayne isn't. So he's not legit. He's got pretensions to high society, but it's never really going to let him in. High society's never going to let the likes of Penguin in, despite the fact of pretensions to it.
He does come from a wealthy family, but it was all squandered, and he's never been able to get it back. So it's kind of like he feels cheated of his birthright as a high society man.
Now, the Golden Age Penguin, i.e., like if you go all the way back to his origins in the 40s, there was a side to his character where he was like a bit of a mummy's boy as well. Like his mother was a kind of influence on him.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I believe that's part of like the original Penguin origin story. But this is the other weird thing with him. As far as I know, Penguin doesn't get a reboot origin post-Crisis.
Oh, like he's always the same.
He's always just, here he is. So he never really gets that proper origin story, to my knowledge. He's just kind of always already established, if that makes any sense. So there is that. And anyway, coming back to this particular Penguin story, anything to write home about? Or
let me just remember what was going on with it at the time. He's captured these enormous peregrine falcons, which he's then threatening the this is one thing I like, is that these stories sort of going onwards, aside from the terrible art, I mean, look at Robin there, just you've got a little bit more. This particular run in general seems to have really fleshed out a lot of the backgrounds, particularly Wayne Manor and the Batcave.
Yes.
So I do like the mementos, like the giant T-Rex in the back at the top, sort of callbacks to earlier runs. But doesn't Batman snap at Robin in this one, or am I thinking of a later story?
I don't know.
I think it's later. But yeah, so he's captured these peregrine falcons. He's got them in an enormous bird cage on some skyscraper. And Batman's determined where the peregrine falcons are and basically just ends up getting trapped in this cage after falling for a penguin-shaped decoy, which is just standing on top of the cage.
I don't know if you ever saw the 1960s Filmation Batman cartoon. Did you ever see that? Filmation. Let's play a clip of that, because I had a VHS tape of this when I was a kid, and let's see if we can find Filmation Batman. play the but this whole this Peregrine Falcon thing reminded me of the 1960s filmation Batman and Robin.
God, this is the one where Batman, is it Batman had almost wore short, like he for some, never mind, just ignore what I'm saying.
Let me just show you a little bit of this filmation 1960 series.
Go for it.
This is Robin in peril.
And now let's go for the Penguin. Your clock has run out, Penguin. You're finished.
Time for just one more play, Batman. And the ball's in my court.
To me, this story reminded me a little bit of that kind of style. You know, it was kind of... Do you agree?
Like,
it was
that's
the sort of thing that would happen in that show. You know, Penguin's, you know, up in his nest with some Peregrine Falcons in the old abandoned, disused warehouse outskirts of town.
So Batman doesn't actually win this one, although he's developed an anti-Peregrine Falcon device, which basically puts the thing, and then the professor, which Penguin has kidnapped, has basically put a marker on Penguin's bottom that that attracts the Peregrine Falcons. So now they're going after him. Yeah.
This is just like
many bird puns incoming there.
But you can see what I mean. Like, but like, you know, considering year one is happening over in the other book, what the hell's going on here? It's just like, okay, we're just gonna act like you know, Crisis on Infinite Earth didn't happen, and we're also kind of randomly back in 1964 or something. So
anyway. Then he tries to bow out and then he gets netted. Don't you trust me? Not a very trusting individual, are you?
Of course, that's the interesting. The other interesting thing about Penguin is that he's the one villain who doesn't go to Arkham, isn't he? He goes to Gotham State Penitentiary or Blackgate, depending on the era. So he's also not insane, which is quite nice.
Mm.
Anyway, now Mike Barr's run. Hooray! Mike Barr is here.
Proper with Alan Davis, not the Alan Davis you're thinking of.
Yeah, and immediately you can see from this cover some Silver Age influence. I'm even thinking of the, I don't know if you're familiar with Dick Sprang, legendary Batman artist.
Mm-hmm.
He was the kind of big Silver Age artist, you know, the big, bright, colorful Joker.
Yeah.
Famously, you know. And you can see there's a lot of kind of Dick Sprang homage in a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, especially when we get to the kind of what you might describe as the Joker cave, because he does seem to have his own special cave where he has his own sort of set of things. But yeah.
And look, the old abandoned Gotham medical supply warehouse.
On little cat feet. So, yes. And for some reason, this looks like Cerebro.
Can I just say something though, Mark? Right?
Yeah.
Is that I kind of love this aspect of Batman. Like some people Batman has to be dark. Batman has to be, you know, the Grim Knight or whatever.
Yeah.
I kind of don't mind this kind of campiness.
As I say, the darkness stuff has to be done really well. So, like, obviously, last time we talked about the slasher one where he's hunting the serial killer who's putting women into dumpsters, and I thought that was really well done. And then you've got other more serious stuff like his whole thing with Nightwing, his whole tiff, and that was brilliant. That was really well done. But then sometimes it's really out of place or it's just boring, like the like hunting
beast.
A KG beast who will never make it onto a top 10 Batman villains list as long as we are still here. But I enjoyed this. I thought that despite the fact it was quite jarring to go from brooding angsty teenage Jason Todd to what we're about to see in a second. Yeah, where he's...
Well, I mean, he's essentially just like Dick Grayson Robin here.
He is proper full... I mean, you've got to read some of these puns as we go.
Here's a question before we carry on. Do you think anybody told Mike Barr, one, there's been a reboot, Mike? Two, this Robin here isn't Dick Grayson from the 60s Batman. It's it's Jason Todd. It's a new character.
Yeah, that's the other thing, because they never reference him by name. And so, about 3 or 4 issues in, and I wonder whether or not he did forget. Yeah,
because I've got a theory that Mike Barr was literally just lifted from like 1976, not told what was going on, and was just like, right,
nothing's happened. Yeah,
because there's a few clues coming up which we'll get into, but anyway, these cat burglars. Now, were these actual minions of Catwoman's, these kind of cat guys?
According to her, they are. I also love that, look, they've got anesthetic gas on the side. It's not a fire extinguisher. And this tank of anesthetic gas comes up again in another story later on. To be fair, it's a little bit more in keeping with the setting, but it's there. He also doesn't know how cardiac resuscitators, defibrillators work, which is where you have to have... but where you have to have both contacts on the same person, otherwise it won't electrocute them. But it's just a bit ridiculous. And Batman just like, yeah, you can kill this guy, don't care. And
okay, then, so we have to stop here. What do you think of Catwoman's outfit here?
Them hip windows don't lie. That's what I'm saying.
This is an interesting Catwoman. So what's going on? Catwoman comes along. Oh yeah, so isn't the basic story here is that Catwoman has kind of been carrying on a little bit with
so she knows who Batman is, and he obviously knows who she is, and she's trying to turn over a new leaf. So Batman, she's turned in her old cronies when they've decided to run a caper without her, and
right.
Where they're at, and Batman is scared because every time he gets close to a woman, they get ripped from him for whatever reason. So yeah. that's where we and start.
You see, if you've ever read any late 70s Batman, this sort of stuff is straight out of the Bronze Age. This is the Denny O'Neill. What's the name of the artist? It's the Batman. It's the Batman from Strange Apparitions, mm-hmm. So again, going into my theory that Mike Barr didn't actually know it was 1986 or 1987, and that changes were afoot, or that he just didn't care and he was like, nope, I'm gonna do something there to make the child in me happy. So essentially, the story here is that Joker, in
his Joker cave there. Look, see.
Joker in the Joker.
His enormous smile shaped desk that he's got there.
Joker's like, I want to bring Catwoman back to the dark side.
No, so it's worse. We're not quite there yet. He basically saying it's the middle of an economic depression, so he's not short of henchmen, but the henchmen are dissatisfied because Joker won't take them out on any crimes, basically, and he's kicking people out. Who
look a bit of John Dee there?
Yeah,
Philistine.
Out your Philistine, and then suddenly he's informed by this man on a ridiculous scooter, which is making clown beep beep noises, beep beep. That basically Catwoman is back on the turf, and she sided with Batman, and he gets his inspiration. And so he wants to take them out. And again, just look at the Batcave here. Again, all the mementos turning up again.
It's lovely, isn't it?
I like it. Yeah.
I always like this Batcave as well. That's the penny from the Penny Plunderer, the Each one of these is does have like some story.
Yeah.
I think this is obviously from some Penguin story. So we'll keep on going then. I see. He knows it's Jason. Wrong, Jay. You see?
Yes. Yeah.
He just doesn't care.
I will make Jason into the image that I want him to be in.
So, it's all nice and colourful, though, isn't it? There's a bit more Catwoman.
And it's also those little moments where he's training Jason, but it doesn't dominate in the same way that the other ones do. Like, it always seems like in the original main book, that he's either always struggling to teach Jason something, or Jason's deliberately going out of his way to piss Batman off in some way, counter to his training. Whereas
I missed that little detail. She's literally got a pot
of cream.
It's so cheesy.
It's super. I like the way it's written, though, and she's written very well to be playing up the cat aspect of her character. So I thought that was good.
Milling around for a clue, old foe, you'll never get the score.
Oh yes, this is a section I was going to ask you about. This, like, Batman is about to BTFO Jason off in a second. But they come to the conclusion. Batman's like, oh, they're all coming up with ideas and they're all wrong. But Batman can see through the mist and is like, Joe Miller is going and his joke book is going to be lifted. So
Gotham Public Library is exhibiting a rare first edition of Joe Miller's joke book all this week.
Holy Gutenberg, Batman.
You see, but that is straight out of Adam West, isn't it? That is exactly what would happen. You can
see that being a storyline from that.
And then he goes, holy Gutenberg, let's go.
And then never do that again. Okay, Batman. Never what? Never lead? Never holy Gutenberg?
That's probably my single favorite panel in everything that we've just... Never do that again. And I would like to think that the reason he reacts like that is because he's reminding him too much of Dick Grayson.
That would make sense.
Because that's very much a Dick Grayson line, and he's saying, like, listen, no, you be your own man, Jason. But I just it was funny.
Don't be child.
Yeah, you just stop short of slapping him, obviously, but...
We don't get the bat slap in this particular run, no. I do like the look on Robin's, Jason's face there on the left as well, where he's just like, it's just such a strange expression.
That's so funny. So you could tell Mike Barr's having fun with this run, at the very least. He was right. They are going to Joe Miller's joke book exhibition.
Hey, look, they're all wearing their COVID face masks.
And then, what's he doing? He's stealing the joke book. He
takes the book and then they smash the case. And then all three of them come swinging in. And again, the puns, just scroll up a little bit for Jace's puns. You were overdue for that, pal. And and that's fine with me.
Very good, yeah. Very good. Whereas Jason Todd in the main book is not making puns, is he?
Ever, no.
Then he tries to recruit Catwoman.
He's fighting her and he's like, are you trying to change your spots? She says, yeah, what if I am? I'm trying to be decent. So he electrocutes her. And it's like,
okay. And then so that they keep on going, we'll latch open on the loony bin. Okay.
And then there's this random Down syndrome chap who has decided that he's going to just annihilate everyone.
Well, he's a Joker goon, right?
Yeah, and it turns out that he's not firing an actual gun, which would have just ended things there and then by blasting through Robin's face. But he has this bizarre Chinese finger trap firing gun that if they struggle, it will make it tighter for some reason.
And he had woman.
Kitty in her cage. But yes.
Yeah, so we'll keep on going.
It's Jade. It's Jade. Yes. Here's a second desk, the J desk.
What I love is that the Gotham authorities just allow Joker to have this like very obviously signposted base in the middle of Gotham. Yeah.
And all of his custom it's, you wonder whether or not it's just a method for him to make his assets not liquid. You know, like he's got all this custom furniture. Oh, and this doctor is as sadistic as he is.
Yeah, he's some like weird. He's developed some technology. Is it to reprogram Catwoman's mind?
Yeah, so it's like a. I think that he says it. You know, it's in the time of early medical technology. So it's like a cat scanner. And of course, right. Because it's a cat, she's the Catwoman. It's a cat scanner. And yeah, it's going to do that and it's going to hurt. And so he wants Catwoman to be awake so that he knows how much pain she's going to be in. So Batman decides to do a little bit of Tai Chi and relax his entire body here. And then rescues Robin. That's a very effeminate looking Joker there.
And then it goes on. This continues now with Catwoman successfully turned by the nefarious Joker. Mm. Now, what's this? Who's this guy?
So Batman's after information. So he and Robin are going to this particular den of thieves who are not doing anything bad at this particular moment, but Batman's had run-ins with at some point. And there's even he seems to be well acquainted with one particular woman in here, who is he keeps beating people up as they come up to him. Yeah, this woman here, Rhonda, who's a woman of the night, shall we see? And look at the look on Batman's face, staying out of trouble.
Can I just say I don't want to just as a kind of tease for the Grant Breyfogle stuff. Compare these low lives with what we see in a bit. I mean, this is like such a colourful, lovely little, you know, it's almost like a kind of Star Wars bar or something.
Yeah, carnival kind of style. And yeah, it does become a lot more homelessy and drug addicty. But yeah,
and then, I mean, even comparing the ladies of the night here. I mean, she's kind of quite a fun prostitute compared to the.
Yellow fishnet and red leather, like I suppose. Yeah, and then Robin, like he just leaves Robin in here with all these people who hate him.
He's like 40 years old,
and I'm like, "I'll have a milk, please." and then go back, and then the prostitute comes over, and he's like, "Oh, I'll make it two."
14-year-old boy.
And then even more campy, he comes up to this bouncer chap and he's like, Moose, your shoelace is untied. I ain't falling for that. And the guy's got these giant zips that are there. So Batman's like, oh, my shoelace is untied. And then that convinces him and he gets smacked about. Oh, yeah, so there's the information broker here. That's who he's after.
Yeah, who is this guy? Did you, when I was reading through this, I was like, who is this guy? I have to look up, like, does he ever appear again? Has he got a backstory? Is this guy? Like, I thought he was like a major character, but apparently not.
No. He's just a stand-in, and he's called The Profile.
Look at his profile. He could have been a major character, damn it.
Wasted opportunity there. But yeah. And he's really worried about being raped in prison. And Batman literally threatens. Look at his face. He literally threatens to frame Profile for a crime by taking his fingerprints off his glass and then planting them at the scene of a robbery. And then tells him that if he doesn't, yes, there you go. And then Profile's like, I don't want to be raped in prison, because that's what Batman's insinuating. So evil Batman says, I like you. You've got a good sense. The Rhonda, the Lady of the Night, says, just grow up a little bit, says, bring him back when he's a little older. He's cute. And Batman's just like, we'll see.
She's a lady, Joe. Just like
Selena. It's just the most it's very bizarre.
It's fun, though, isn't it? I do think this Mike Barr run is just wild. Selena comes round. Can I just say it's literally called Jester Novelties, where his head up.
just put a black ban on clown based industries in the city, and Joker problem goes away.
Then there's a fight involving some Skittles.
God, and more puns.
There we go. You're about to die, haven't you?
Oh God, are you pinned down?
Yeah, so many puns. I mean, the pun Mike Barr's line per run pun per line ratio is quite high, I would say. It's very colourful, isn't it?
Super campy.
And then what happens now? They basically crash the joint. This goon is back trying to do karate. He gets his ass handed to him, and Joker's got this Jokermobile now. And
it's the Jokermobile car again. Ridiculous. Sorry, I've just had an email through from the Pathy folks.
Oh yeah.
Who said, and for those of you who don't know, I produced this trailer the other day and they slapped me with some ludicrous bill, £350 for a minute or something. And they told me, well, yeah, that was the cost. And then they said, if you want a license for YouTube use worldwide in perpetuity, it will cost you £24 per second of footage used with a 60-second minimum purchase, using as many different clips as you like, and this excludes VAT.
£24 a second.
Yeah.
So they said, "Are you going to pay it?"
No, I'm not going to pay it. I'm going to just take the video down. But in this, they said, as a commercial licensing company, we do charge commercial rates. And then they've given me some alternatives for public domain.
I've never seen that before. Yeah. I mean, I've had the, we're going to monetize this, and you know. But never the we want £300 off you business. Pathy, so avoid using anything from them, clearly.
Yeah. Unless we become ludicrously successful and we can get a million hits per video. Yeah.
But the thing is, as I told you, archive.org, if you know the clip you're looking for, most of them are on there, public domain.
I should find some things, and I should hopefully be able to do it. And they are very good. They said, we realize it's quite expensive, so here's some public domain sites you might want to use instead. So yeah. Right.
What happened? Basically, she turns babyface again, Catwoman.
Yeah, well, she's turned against Batman, and he doesn't know what to do. So he's found this doctor, and he's really angry. So Robin there just has to prevent him from beating the doctor to death.
Can I just make a comment about Joker's weight here?
Oh, he's very slim.
That's a very slim Joker, isn't it?
They said crime wasn't paying him very much at the time. He was lacking in inspiration. Maybe he's just going through his anorexic phase there. Because good grief. Catwoman has... Joker asked Catwoman who Batman was, because obviously he knows she knows. And she's given him a name, but it's not Bruce Wayne. And so Joker has kidnapped this guy and his family, and has got them in a literal giant cat's cradle.
Yeah.
And now he's like, show yourself, Batman. And no one, obviously the guy can't do that. So he's very confused. Excuse that. But yeah, so he's threatening to kill the to kill this little girl, and Catwoman naturally it says I'm a thief, not a murderer, and Batman and Robin burst in at just the right time for Joker to be very confused and try and spray Robin with acid.
Look at that. So there we go. One thing that is confusing sometimes is that Robin is always written as being kind of too weak to take any villain on his own, but then also has moments of being able to like kick Joker into the wall. There's a kind of inconsistent power level. So when it comes to the various villains, I find versus Robin. Sometimes it seems like Robin is super tough, and other times it's like, oh, you know, it's too dangerous to go up against Two-Face on your own type thing. So
yeah.
So I
can't tell what happens here, whether or not it's just Robin got up a page, mate. Robin kicks him, and whether or not he actually ends up frying this girl, because I don't think she dies, but she does get a really nasty shock. And then they don't think they ever reference it. Like, they just, she's just like, so it wakes her up. So she gets electrocuted by Joker's killing glove, and then it wakes her up.
So there we go. Don't be catty, Selina. And then he tries to get away.
He gets double crossed by Catwoman, who escapes and knocks both Batman and Joker down. And yeah. Then Batman's going to kill Joker because he's taken his woman from him. And again, Robin has to stop him from going full psycho.
So we're probably going to have to pick up the pace here a little bit, I think, given how much stuff.
Yeah. Have we been going for an hour yet?
I think we should pick up the pace. But there's a Scarecrow story now. I'll just quickly whiz through. We don't need to go through.
This one was fairly forgettable, I thought.
Line by line. But there's Scarecrow. What do you think of this Scarecrow design?
I like it. It's more. I think it's more in keeping with what he becomes later on.
Alan Davis is not bad on this run, I would say, as the artist.
Nope.
What goes on in this story? Remind me. There's a race.
Scarecrow has developed this new toxin which doesn't cause fear, it removes fear, and he's given it to this Daredevil chap who has then had a horrific accident because he's got no cares at all. And Scarecrow actually ends up killing him. So they're trying to work out what's going on.
this is where I took this panel from. Look, I was claiming this was Squire Turnip, but then somebody claimed it was me.
So yeah, they changed the psychology of fear to basic economics by Sal.
So there we go. There he is getting bullied back in his college days. And this is part of his reason for taking revenge as the Scarecrow.
He doesn't like people very much, so they're looking for him now, and we keep going. And yeah, so Scarecrow is basically blackmailing him and saying it's going to cost you 50 grand if you want to get the antidote to feel fear again. and then they have a bit of a fight, and it doesn't work very well because Robin ends up getting basically gassed with fear gas and kidnapped by Scarecrow. And then once this guy refuses to pay up, Scarecrow makes him jump out a window and he dies. So there's that.
Well, now, in the pantheon of Batman villains, where do you put Scarecrow out of interest?
He's a real middle tier in my mind.
I think there's an obvious A tier and B tier, and then like C, D.
There is no C. There is only D tier after that.
What I'm saying is, I would put Scarecrow at the top of the B tier, along with like Mr. Freeze. I'd probably put Poison Ivy in that bracket. Trying to think of who else would go in there. So perhaps they've got some name recognition, but they're never going to be like one or two, are they?
Perhaps another time we should do a Batman villain tier list.
Yeah, a tier list of all of the villains, a ranking maybe. Mm-hmm. Where are you putting the mime?
The mime. Yeah. Like, if there's an S tier, the mime is an S tier.
So we'll keep on. There's no. Who's this guy? Alvin. Is he another one of these daredevils?
Yeah, and basically, he's being taken by Scarecrow again. I thought this was quite a forgettable story, but he's got this weird tranquilizer gun thing, which he uses. So instead of killing Batman, he just tranks him with about 8 darts, which should kill him, but doesn't, and informs him that he's got Robin hostage. So, yeah, there we go. And he's got a load of these people who've got no fear, who are running trucks into each other for him. And
you can see what Mike Barr's going for. Like, this is like proper villain of the week, you know.
Oh, yeah, complete with these bizarre traps. Oh, yeah, this is ridiculous. So he falls into a pit filled with water. And then these two assault rifles or, you know, sentry turrets come out the wall and blam the water for 10 minutes.
No, I read an interview with Mike Barr saying that he really loves massive traps. Like, he thinks that the spirit of Batman is in ludicrous massive traps of this nature. So he just basically just went to town. We've already seen like the giant 8 ball and the skittles and stuff last week. Now we've got that kind of pit of doom. That's a pretty good left hook from Batman there on
quad. And Robin's like, how did you survive 10 minutes in without drowning or getting shot to pieces? And it turns out that we have a really ridiculous sort of cop out here where
now, one thing I want to say just while I really don't like this aspect of the Mike Barr run. The fact that Batman continually calls Robin chum, I don't think Batman would say chum.
No, it's not a very Batman-esque thing to say. Apart from, you know, ironically to some villain as he's punching him in the face, but you wouldn't think this. Yeah, so he held his breath the entire time, maneuvered himself into a corner so he wouldn't get diced into pieces, and then used his cape, which had stored oxygen from the fall, to breathe for 10 minutes.
Ridiculous. And then they apprehend Scarecrow.
Another anorexic.
And then look at that. Look at that for a bit of foreshadowing from Barr.
Yeah. So he was really afraid. Or Batman.
His worst fear.
Mm.
And look at that. His worst fear is realized. And it literally ends with maybe someday.
I can see my worst fear. It's that Batman won't stop calling him chum even in the last thing. Maybe someday I'll tell you, chum.
Chum. But, I mean, that's a bit of wild foreshadowing there, considering what happened.
Well, I was going to say, at this point in the run, they don't know that they're going to kill him off. So, it's impressive.
And I mean, even if they did, right, even if it was the plan, there's no way Mike Barr is either A, told or B, cared. So this was entirely his own idea, you know.
As Chad's saying, I'm Batman, chum.
Now, can I just say, among kind of continuity nerds and people who love to date these things, this tombstone here is an absolute gift because it gives you Robin's age, it gives you his date of birth,
he's 12.
There are websites that are absolutely dedicated to this sort of thing, and that tombstone is giving so much information that is not usually given. So, because you can then use that to then think, well, how far into Batman's career is he? How old is Batman here? When was Batman born? You could work all of that out just from this. Believe it or not, people have done that. So there we go. Then we have... Oh, yeah. So I want to skip over this because I don't know about you. This is the 50-year anniversary edition because it was 50 years since the start of Detective Comics.
And they have this bizarre Sherlock Holmes story, don't they?
Yeah. So, well, it's Sherlock Holmes and a pile of other kind of characters and be, you know, elongated man and various kind of minions who've been part of the Detective Comics.
Yeah,
I thought this was, there's something about anniversary issues that don't date well.
Well, there's one there's one that does particularly well where they redo his origin, but that's later on. But this one in particular, I found it quite difficult to follow the story. It wasn't that interesting. Basically, it centers around the son of Moriarty. Or the two sons of Moriarty, because it turns out one of them is evil and one of them is good. And yeah, they go through, and then there's, it goes on for three issues. So you've got this one.
Oh, it's just never ending.
Yeah, you go get this one, and then there's a second one, which is just, which is a, there's no Batman in it at all. It's a Holmes and Watson story. And then there's the third one where they come back and try and give it a resolution, and it basically turns out Sherlock Holmes is still alive through bizarre means, and he doesn't smoke anymore.
These things where it's like multiple writers, multiple artists, special edition, you know, it's they're never that good in my experience. They're always a bit like kind of unwelcome like this. I was really enjoying this one, and then the disc just, I was just like, come on, get back to the cheesy Scarecrow and Joker stories. I didn't like this at all.
I didn't like Moriarty as a villain. I felt like they tried to be too convoluted and contrived and grounded it in, like, Batman has no business being in a bloody Sherlock Holmes story. And then there's this whole thing with the elongated man, who I found distinctly unlikable as well.
It's ridiculous.
And I couldn't help thinking, because he does this thing where he constantly elongates his neck. Yeah. Right? It doesn't matter if he's fighting or whatever. He just, like, if he wants to talk to you, he will literally curve his neck around and look at you with just his head on this neck thing. And it was just terrifying. It'd freak you out if you did it in real life. Just ridiculous.
Has no place in this world, elongated man.
No, I mean,
it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah, so this is the second issue. So this is the one where it's Sherlock Holmes. And I enjoyed this kind of as a Sherlock Holmes story, but I was reading Batman and I wanted to read Batman. And instead we have this bizarre thing involving a plot to kill Queen Victoria using these weird red leeches and a doppelganger who, yeah, there you go. They're taking that leech off him, which is just killing him, apparently.
It's just interminable. You know, we were talking about how sales were really down at this point. Do you think it was because of shit like this?
It's probably like, who wants to, they're going, oh, I'll pick up the Detective Comics. Although I can see why Detective Comics has its kind of Sherlock Holmes crossover, but I think that's too much. It's not what people are buying DC for, you know?
Well, I mean, in the 50-year history of DC, of Detective Comics, people bought it for Batman, for God's sake, not for all this rubbish. And yeah. it carries on.
And here's the final issue. So, they have this whole thing where Batman has to determine that one of the Moriartys is a good guy and not a bad guy. Elongated Man's keen on going after them, but Batman doesn't like him very much. And, there we go. Keep going.
Is that feminist symbol? Kind of women
for peace, apparently.
Okay. God, it's just never ending.
So there's this guy, and he's a real pain, and then Elongated Man manages to be used as a parachute, and Batman comes in and kicks something. Kicks this book, which is actually an explosive.
Is that the Queen? No.
Yes.
Princess Anne, is it?
Member of the royal family. Anyway.
Princess Margaret, I want to say. God, it's...
And then, Holmes is still alive, but he's... Yeah, if you read it, scroll up a little bit, he says, I have a proper diet, and you've gone past it. Because it's in the middle there. Proper diet, a distillation of royal jelly developed in my beekeeping days in the rarefied atmosphere of Tibet, where I live now. So he doesn't smoke, even though Batman offers him a smoke, so...
I mean, come on. Sherlock Holmes would have been...
Apparently he's like 120 years old or something. So it's just
ridiculous. Nonsense. Absolutely.
And then, Yeah, and then they end it with some sentimentality about how it's a good thing that Moriarty Jr. is not actually evil.
Because that's what DC readers really wanted in 1986. It's a story with a 120-year-old Sherlock Holmes, elongated man, with Batman and Robin. I mean,
there is a little nugget of gold at the end here, which is a quote by G.K. Chesterton.
Amazing.
Also why people bought DC Comics, you know.
The romance of the police force is thus the whole romance of man. It is based on the fact of morality is the most dark and daring of conspiracies. And okay,
oh,
and
now yes, we get here to we are.
Right. Now we get to the centerpiece of my case that Mike Barr didn't realize it was 1986 and in fact thought it was still 1976, because here is the imposter Mad Hatter, as I laid out in my guide to Batman.
The Madder Hatter, if you will.
Now, we'd already been told that this imposter Mad Hatter had been killed by the original Mad Hatter who'd returned.
And then he just randomly pops up again.
But now he's back with no explanation whatsoever, no acknowledgement of the earlier story, no acknowledgement of the original Mad Hatter, and he's still called Jervis Tetch. So,
continuity is a thing of beauty in these things.
Yeah, so Mike, I mean, again, I would say, well, you know, Max Alan Collins was saying Denny O'Neill didn't give anybody a Bible or didn't give anybody any direction. I honestly think that Mike Barr was not told a single thing by Denny O'Neill. He's just like, I can just imagine him picking up the phone saying, hey, Mike Trenzi coming on Detective Comics with, you know, 9 months or something. Yeah, right. What shall I do? Oh, whatever you want. Bye.
And here we are
with original, with imposter Mad Hatter.
It's either that, or he just didn't give a shit, retconned a load of stuff, and then just the editors didn't care enough to do their proper fact checking on it.
Now I happen to look, because there's a website where you can check the chronology of various characters. This Mad Hatter's last appearance was in 1978.
So that was the last. It's been a decade, basically.
It's been a decade since he appeared. Now he's back with no explanation whatsoever, despite what had happened. And I mean, basically, the story is absolutely ridiculous.
He's being let out of prison, and Batman and Robin are taking him from prison for no apparent reason, and say you can never wear a hat again. So he says, okay, I'm going to go straight, walks out, immediately buys a newspaper and makes a hat for himself and becomes the most evil man alive.
Can I just point one thing out, right? This guy is clearly mental, okay? He's obviously insane.
Yeah.
Why did he go to bog standard prison, not Arkham? Like, clearly this guy belongs in Arkham.
I have no idea. No idea. And the fact that at this point, where he's still clearly exhibiting tender, like, how difficult did they think it would be for him to acquire a hat once they let him go? Because he's just going, could I see that hat? Could I just for a moment wear that hat? Could I have that hat, please? Could we go to a haberdashery so I can buy a hat? No. And if you wear a hat again, you know that you're going to go back to prison. Well, could I have that hat, please?
How did he get through the parole board?
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking.
I'm reformed. Honestly, Gov.
Give me a hat. I'll show you how reformed I am. It's like, no. And then we get this, where he's suddenly like, I'm feeling proper. I'm feeling there back to my old self. And he goes back. He has a ridiculous set of hats in this, which I did enjoy, despite the lunacy of this run. So if we run through this fairly quickly. So he sends a clue for no adequately explored reason, as many of the villains do in this. He sends a clue to Batman as to what he's going to do next. I've gone hatless, Batman, but not in the way you want. And then it's up to them to piece it together. So he holds up this club.
The Liar's Club
with a whole load of other hatted henchmen, collecting all the valuables in hats, naturally.
Why are his crew like kind of cowboys? They all seem a bit
Like Fedora, that's what it is. Or Trilby, perhaps. So, yeah, so they go, boss, you they never figure out your clue. Why did you give them a clue? I just still don't understand. So, yeah, they have a bit of a fist fight. And then he puts on a fireman's hat which can shoot fire. With a parrot force of 1,000 suns. Because it looks like it's...
This is like, to me, this is the peak of Mike Barr's run, is this ridiculous Mad Hatter story. Look, there's a big hat sale.
And that's front page news, because that's like proper big text. And so Bruce then says, oh, do you want some cake? And then Alfred saying, through it, basically gives him a hint as to where Hatter's going next. So they're running through again. Lovely shots of the Batcave there. And so they're going to a hockey stadium where if you score 3 times, it's a hat trick, which is the only clue he needs. He's only doing things tangentially related to hats now. So...
This is the second time we find ourselves in a baseball stadium.
Hockey stadium. And then they end up in a sports museum, which has giant replica sports equipment. Batman ends up on a giant replica snooker table using a giant replica snooker cue in order to hit the white ball, as we will see in the next panel, to knock out all these henchmen.
I should point out it is a pool table.
Oh yeah, sorry.
Yeah. But yes, indeed. So
that is an enormous painting, like, by the way. I just want to point that out, that this enormous, like, how much that would have cost. And a bit egotistical, I think, perhaps for the Waynes. There we go.
Yeah.
Do you notice this really dark moment in the middle of this fairly light-hearted story upper panel, where Batman has asked Commissioner Gordon to come to Bruce Wayne running for a candidacy for something, and Commissioner Gordon basically says, you know, why? What would your father think? You know, if he were here, he'd. And Batman Bruce just turns to him and just goes, but he can't be commissioner, can he? It's just like this moment of pure dark distillation in the middle
don't
of the
bring day. Up, don't bring up my parents. This might be Mike Barr's run, but I'm still Batman underneath it all.
grimacy Batman. And then it all smiles again, yeah.
Yeah, and then we've got this Wayne for Councilman hat business.
And of course they don't. So whilst he realizes these hats are not something he ordered, he's gone off and got changed. And it turns out that they're Whirligig saws.
remote controlled.
What does it say on his shirt there at the top? Crown Hat Company. Okay.
Yeah. So we get the kind of... murderous buzzsaw hats.
Obligatory dodges and the use of a gun for what a gun isn't meant to be used for. Rocket ship.
It's just...
How did he get the funding for this? He's just come out of prison on parole.
And then
Batman gives a ridiculous reason again, above, which is... that, you know, if you'd been paying attention, Robin, you could have determined the frequency that he was using to control the hats. If you'd taken the time to just observe, you'd have known what the frequency was, and then we could recontrol the hats ourselves. And that's that. So, yeah, but at the end of this, Hatter shoots at Robin, and basically he takes 4 shots to the chest.
Yes, and this is significant because this injury carries over, as we'll see. This is actually where we got the year 2 kind of interim, which we're going to skip over. Can you imagine being a Detective Comics reader where you go from the special anniversary issue to this, to then year 2? I mean, it's just madness. So anyway, when we come back from year two, this is the, I think this is Robin still injured from Mad Hatter's. Yeah.
So he gets taken back to Crime Alley to a, we keep going down to, cause they're basically just setting the scene. Yeah. So there's a memorial clinic set up by Thomas Wayne. I really enjoyed this issue, I have to say. I don't know about you, but,
this woman here, she's like a big ally who knows who Bruce Wayne is.
Yeah. She took care of him as a child after the death of his parents. So whilst Jason's being rehabilitated and healing and that sort of thing, Batman is going through his own sorrows, having to explain. So she kind of fills in for Nightwing in a way from the previous.
Yeah, I mean, she's really on Bruce's case. I thought she was like,
yeah.
And this was a kind of strange turn in the middle of all this wackiness. We've got this pretty serious issue, Bar just kind of slings in here. We get a bit of the flashback to the night his parents died.
And again, gorgeous art all the way through.
Yeah,
and
lovely art.
A bit of a departure from, the campy style and all the reds and yellows. Really good.
But then he has this like real, you know, quite awkward heart-to-heart with this woman. And she's really onto him.
Yeah, because she knows all about Dick Grayson and the fact that he had a close call with Joker. So they are now having this thing. I love this shot with the bat. Like, just...
Yeah, and she's saying, I didn't choose Jason for my work. He was chosen by it, as I was chosen. So, like, in these moments where you're thinking, like, is Batman like all that? Like, is he slightly mad himself? Like, what is this stuff about being chosen by it that he's going on about? Like, he's almost talking like a kind of Calvinist manifest destiny here. Well, and she's not having any of it.
No, she doesn't want it. She's like, you think you're noble and heroic. You're not. You're doing it all for yourself to basically cope with the loss of your parents. You've never grown up. And then she brings up the fact that he got into fights as a child. Batman's basically like, I don't care. It's like, if people hurt others, they've crossed the line, and I'm going to beat the crap out of them. But yeah, if we go down a little further, we get this instance where he pretends to sleep, and then he sneaks out, steals the gun from his parents' killer, and basically has this whole thing. I love this shot as well with the Batman kind of the logo.
Yeah,
coming behind him, and just the rage and the pain there, and he's revisiting the scene of his parents' death, and he finds the gun.
It comes out of nowhere, this issue, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Considering what we've been looking. Look, there's the Sherlock Holmes tie-in.
And this as well is kind of the beginning of him being... Because the whole series takes a bit of a turn from this point, and you can see the look on his face reading The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. He becomes very much grimmer.
Do you think Denny O'Neill, after like however many months it had been, rang up Mike Barr and said, Mike, listen, I know you said you could do whatever you would do, but there's a few things I need to tell you about the direction we're going in and what you've been doing. Like, can you kind of rein it in a bit and bring in some serious stuff? Yeah, sure, boss. And then look, he just turns in this stonking, like, amazing issue of.
And don't forget, this is a big issue because obviously everyone knows the origin of Batman if they're a Batman fan. So this was a real push to get readers back, as far as I understand it, and so it had to be good. So I imagine that. If they actually edited this one.
Look at that panel here. But this isn't the real you, Bruce. It's the only me there is, Leslie.
It's very dramatic, very broody.
But it's like we always say, the mask is Bruce Wayne and the real figure is Batman.
But it's not as angry and aggressive, because when Nightwing confronts him, it's a lot of kind of anger and resentment and that sort of like not treating each other as equals. But these two... They clearly do treat each other that way, and they have these moments of kind of softness in the middle of the the hard talk, as it were.
I think she literally just says to him, but your life is so, so empty.
And yours isn't?
So he's like, okay, I accept that, but... And you?
Yeah, no you. And she's like, at least I have my work. And he's just like, well, this is mine in some form or another. And then we get these flashbacks, which again were absent from previous iterations of his origin story, basically talking about how he went and pretended to be a spoilt rich kid who got really bad grades, then dressed up as a nerd so that he could quiz his lecturers and read and study. And then when they told him it was too advanced, he snuck in to the libraries at night and studied the stuff. Again, pre-internet era.
Board of Criminal Justice. I mean, you'd think, wouldn't you, that when he was disguised as the nerd, that he could have maybe like made friends with Jonathan Crane and, you know, stopped him becoming the Scarecrow. But that didn't happen at Gotham University.
I think in an earlier panel as well, he points out that he had to pay people to be his friends. There's that.
So, they have this flashback, and then why do you do it?
If you don't think you can make a difference, and and he's saying, well, you know, why on earth do you patch up criminals? You know they'll be back tomorrow. Or why do you treat addicts? He's like, because I have to. And he's saying, I know. It's the same for him. Oh, no, I do like the fist on the window there, just like,
yeah,
I know.
Yes. I don't know if he even exists anymore or if he's anything but another disguise. So there it is. Bruce Wayne is the disguise. Batman confirms it himself. And what I love about this is that he is hating every single moment of this chat, because you know that Batman does not want to talk. The Batman who says chum doesn't want to talk.
He doesn't like confronting himself. He has this kind of facade of what his mission is, and as long as he's doing that and he doesn't have to think too hard about it, he's happy in his own way. But as soon as he has to actually process and move on from things, he doesn't.
And of course, that's why he pushes everybody away, isn't it, Mark? That's why he won't let anybody get close to him, as Nightwing said.
In subtle ways, I suspect that's why you push me away.
So
there's these little nuggets of conversation that people who don't watch the Deepest Lore Batman streams won't get, you see.
Well it is indeed the Deepest Lore, isn't it? Walt Whitman quotation at the end there.
I think he was told after this no more quotations, because they don't appear again. They just stopped doing them. He must have been experimenting.
Okay, so Norm, was that the last? Norm Breyfogle is already on board now. So yeah. I forgot that we get a one bar and Breyfogle. So clearly Alan Davis had gone.
Yeah.
And not that Alan Davis. Not the QI Alan Davis, the artist Alan Davis. So Breyfogle, and already classic Breyfogle, I would say. This is very him.
Yeah. Especially the composition of the shots as well.
Yeah, the movement, the always in the, you know, emerging out of the shadows. Breyfogle loves the Batman in the shadows idea.
I did like this issue, actually. I thought this was interesting, but we're moving into grittier Batman now. So these people
it's obvious looking back, isn't it, that Barr got a memo.
Yeah.
Barr was told, right,
behave
after this Mad Hatter issue. Come on now.
Yeah, but look, we're going back to we're going in a new direction here. None of this Silver Age crap.
So you have
this weird this foreshadowing moment here with Two-Face.
Yeah,
who's got a plan, but we don't know what it is yet. We won't know for another issue. And it's whizzed through here. There's a load of people stealing blood and a chap.
Classic. Another classic Breyfogle shot.
Yeah.
And
then they come down and beat a load of people up. As usual.
Gosh, a kick to the chin.
And then Robin's basically taunting Batman because he beat up more bad guys than Batman did. So Batman's like, well, you missed one, and then they interrogate him. This is the worst thing. Like, if you go up a thing, he says, this guy's like, I can't tell you because they'll kill me. And instead of Batman doing his usual thing of like threatening him to break every bone in his body or something, he's just like, suit yourself. I'm going to find him anyway. And when I do, they're going to think you sold him out anyway. So you're going to just leave him to his fate, basically.
Which is fair, right? I mean, do you think they brought in Breyfogle here to make things darker as well? Be like, okay, Norm, keep an eye on Mike because he's a bit of a wild one. If nothing else, you can make the art dark. Because look at the way Batman is lurking in these pictures. I mean, literally in the shadows.
There is a marked difference, and we will notice as well when we get onto the sort of second volume that the art changes quite dramatically, so that Batman's mask, which as you can see in these shots, is quite often blue with sort of hints of black, even though it's kind of theorized to be black all over, it's just easier to paint with blue. They switch it so that they're using mainly black for the blue aspects of his costume.
I should just mention, I love the fact this doctor seems to be Vincent Price. I'll just
This guy has sold himself for 100 grand so his family can survive. This character, I love this character, Nurse Wrench. And, yes. She's a force to be reckoned with because this guy tries to intimidate the doctor. So she literally dives under his bed and beats the crap out of. Look, you can see in that shot, he won't stop until he says.
Now, I assumed that this was a man dressed as a nurse, but no, she's just one double hard nurse.
Yeah.
So, And, she's back.
Yeah. So Robin's sort of back to full strength as far as we're concerned. But Batman's been sneaking around her records while she's been tending to him so that he can find out where the blood's going and who the victim's going to be.
And look how in the Breyfogle art, Robin is immediately more serious. He's not the kid. Like he seems to have grown up a little bit, even in just the way he's drawn here. We don't get those kind of silly 12-year-old eyes. This is more like a kind of switched-on teenager now.
Or the soy face smiles that he's kind of famous, like lots of teeth on display. But even here, like where he's supposedly smiling and saying, you know, let's go get him, you bet, Batman. Again, he's calling him chum there. even there, he's got a kind of that kind of slanted eyebrows look to him, you know, where he's grim and ready for the fight rather than.
Can you imagine?
Hello, is your father?
So there you go. Batman's just broken into this family's home looking for their father,
who is a criminal, which is why they're scared of him. And he's like, well, if he's gone straight, he's got nothing to fear from me, but I'm going to go rescue him because they didn't actually want him to sell himself away to, you know, give a heart transplant.
Yeah, and there's Vincent Price back again.
Oh yes, the Batman has found the place. There's the anesthetic gas again. Batman has found the place because it's got a generator, even though it shouldn't, apparently. And yeah, Wrench is fighting Robin.
Brassy kid.
And
he can't breathe. Yeah. My gosh, she's a unit, isn't she?
Yeah, and he uses her head to knock out the generator, and that's definitely a killing blow on the corner of that.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's a nasty.
That's inside nasty hit. Her head right there. So, yeah. But Batman's flooded the whole place with anesthetic. So the chap who's going to have a heart transplant dies. Batman's sad about this for a moment, but then has a fight with another person with a canister of anesthetic gas and rescues the book.
And now it's revealed what all this surgery business was about.
Yes.
Isn't it? Because if I can remember, he was having plastic surgery to look like Two-Face. Is that right?
No, so this is another guy. So Two-Face has this deal with this guy, and we don't hear anything more about it. Then we get that self-contained story. Then this guy wakes up and is Two-Face. And we
So what, this guy isn't the guy from the last story?
Nope, he's just a random person.
Oh, right.
He turns out that he was an actor who was starring in the Two-Face musical. The story of Two-Face, and then in a horrific accident, he also had acid poured on his face, which made him go mad and pretend to be Two-Face permanently. So they gave him plastic surgery to turn him back to normal, and then Two-Face has just paid to have that plastic surgery undone. So that's
okay, yeah. Right. So this is an imposter Two-Face running around here.
Yeah, and he's trying his best. But yeah, and the reason Batman figures it out is, well, there's this whole little thing here with Jason Todd losing his cool, because obviously he knows Two-Face murdered his dad.
Yeah.
And then Batman's like, well, it's not a real Two-Face, because he's left-handed and the real Two-Face is right-handed. So that's what we got going on there.
From that one where we had the flashbacks onwards, you can see Barr is tying this into the main book now. This is clearly like building towards. They must have had a chat and said, listen, there's a whole character arc for Jason Todd here. We're bringing in Jim Starlin, who's going to kill him off, or we're thinking about it, or something like this. So we need to give Jason Todd more, like, because this clearly ties into what we find out in the main Bat book,
yeah,
about Two-Face being
the killer of Jason Todd's folks'
father. Yeah.
So can you see what I'm saying about they're starting to bring more black into depictions of Batman as well, just going down.
Yes.
Like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, the art, there's a marked shift, obviously, because Breyfogle is the artist as well.
Well, I don't think he's the colorist, though. I don't know who's doing the inking, but they've definitely
It's usually a guy called Dick Giordano, but we'll have to double check.
So they find Two-Face at a Mirror Works, because he has to go and be at a Mirror Works, because
it's
the only place he can see two of himself. And they're going to throw Jason into molten glass, which is a bit of a nasty way to go. And then this great shot, this great eight ass shot that we have of him kicking them in the face. Batman's trying to get through to him, but it's not working. And he's revealing to Jason there that it's an imposter Two-Face. So they're trying to set a trap now. Yeah, there's the origin story of him getting accidentally acided in the face. They're trying to attract Sloane, who's the imposter, and the real Two-Face to a confrontation now.
Does this go on for another issue? Or
does it wrap up here? I think it wraps up towards the end here. Yeah, so they do it, and Two-Face has these weird guns which only work if you have two of them. And they have a fight, and the guy's like, stop calling me Sloane. And then the real Two-Face turns up. Yeah.
Here it is. Here's the face off.
And now they're trying to prove to one another who's the real Two-Face. So they're shooting their own henchmen. They don't really care. And then they're going to get all blown up with ice.
Oh, no. Look, it does. To be continued.
Oh, God. And they've even put
carries
two,
on.
Two spells.
So I noticed Breyfogle's gone from the art now. They've changed the artist again.
It's temporary, I think, but yeah. He always looks like the Incredible Hulk in the shot there at the top. This bit was fairly forgettable. They're basically just...
Okay, wrapping up on this two-page story. Yeah,
they're just explaining everything that we have already deduced. Batman breaking down things and slicing his own wrists in order to escape.
It seemed to go on forever, that bit in the fridge.
Yeah.
When they're in the freezer. But now we're wrapping up. And then he says, listen, you let your emotions get away with you again, basically. So we're teasing the recklessness of Todd. Yes.
But it's interesting again that earlier in that same shot, earlier in the same thing, when he confronts him about his emotions the first time they have the confrontation, Todd snaps back at him because he says, you let your emotions get the better of you. And he goes, well, like, you've never let your emotions get the better of you. And he's like, we're not talking about me. And that's, yeah.
So where is this version of Jason Todd is a bit more conciliatory, isn't he?
Hmm.
We carry on going.
You're too late, it said there.
there's a huge amount of two puns yet again.
Ridiculous, right?
And again, we get the it's almost like Barr couldn't help himself. He has to make this as campy as possible now with the
huge. I don't know why. He just has this thing about huge.
Yeah, big huge death traps, art. Huge sets. It's fun, but I felt this Two-Face story went on for absolute ever. I mean, look at it. It just goes on and on and on. So, yeah, it still hasn't wrapped up.
There's something about the Declaration of Independence in there. But yeah, they just... It's fairly forgettable, this one. They have another confrontation.
Oh, Gordon gives somebody a punch, look.
So. It's good to see. Good to see. It looks like Stan Lee, doesn't he, really? In his older years.
I guess it keeps on going and going, this story. It never ends.
And there we go. So thank God. Yeah.
Right. And then we get.
They seem to have given Two-Face some kind of massive. They seem to assume that he has the biggest appeal. But I can't stand him.
And here's this bloody Millennium tie-in again. This was so awful
Right, Ray Fogle's back for the art, and you can tell. Obviously not for this cover, but this chap Duffy.
Yeah.
Duffy's written this one. I skipped this story, if I'm perfectly honest. It is exactly the same as
the other Millennium tie-in thing.
The other Millennium one, but just from a different perspective, and it's just a lot of.
It was annoying the first time.
Yeah, there's just a lot of Commissioner Gordon's side of it that you didn't get to see before, whilst he's been replaced
with these manhunters. Again. Well,
I just didn't care in the slightest.
So I don't know. Are we going to get through two or three? We feel like we've gone long. There's the Dick Sprang art. Look. Dick Sprang, mm-hmm. who was about 70 or maybe even older than that, pops in to do this. He just remembers the history.
Classic. Do you like the one at the top right there with the smiling sort of faces there? That's classic, isn't it?
Yeah, really good. I mean, you can see the classic Penguin, classic Joker, and just nice, isn't it? Really good. Mm. So.
Well, if you'd like, we can leave it here. I mean, we've been going for over an hour and a half, so we could tie it in next time.
Well, let me see. There's been some super chats. Why don't we do these super chats? And then, so let's have a look. We'll see what people have been saying. And then I did kind of want to get onto the Grant and Bray Fogle. Maybe we could have a very quick – it depends how much time you have, Mark. How much time do you have?
I can give you another half an hour or 40 minutes if you like.
Okay. All right. So Jedi Knight Anakin Cringewalker says, could you speculate on the black market Gotham henchman must run, trading outfits for different bosses depending on who is in and out of prison?
Well, the Mad Hatter had to make his fortune for his hat-shaped devices somehow, clearly running the haberdashery.
I think a tailor for Gotham's criminal underworld is a pretty lucrative profession. I mean, clearly the profile is involved in that world in some way, so there's plenty of business opportunities. Jedi Knight Anakin Cringewalker says, would a progressive Gotham administration provide no questions fashion exchange programs, a la needle exchange programs in real life? Well, I've got this theory, especially as we get into the Grant Bray Fogle run, that Gotham is run by a kind of super progressive Democrat administration, which Bruce Wayne probably funds, which then provides a kind of constant supply of crime for Batman. So there's kind of a strange supply and demand thing going on.
You're too jaded. That's what.
So, yes. What else?
They're all just victims of Reaganomics, AA, don't you know?
Let's have a look then at volume two very quickly. There, yeah. We might not get on to volume three, or we could. I mean, rather than going through it bit by bit, we could just talk generally about the. I'm not sure about that Blind Justice story that was at the end, which wasn't by Grant. But we could talk just more generally about this run by Alan Grant and John Wagner. I'll just we'll have a little look at the volume two. So essentially what happens here is that that Two-Face story finished Barr's run, and now we've got Alan Grant who comes in with his partner in crime, who's a chap called John Wagner. And they always wrote as a duo, but at some point they have a falling out and Wagner leaves, and it's Jess Grant and Breyfogle. But for the entirety of this, i.e. in all of volume two and volume three, as far as I saw, it was Grant and Wagner the whole way. So clearly beyond issue 600, there must be Grant only stories. But there's even after, so I think we could see a darker turn coming even in the Mike Barr stuff, but now it really comes, doesn't it?
Look at this
world. Look at the world of Gotham here.
This story I really enjoyed, this fever one, just because I think it really, they didn't pull any punches with it at all.
Yeah, and you can just see this is a grimier, this is almost like the world of like New York in the late 70s, like Taxi Driver New York, kind of. It's really grim, gritty. A
bouncer on every door and crime hides in every corner.
Yeah, look, graffiti and prostitutes and druggies and homeless people, and I mean, it's just a kind of...
Just look at the look on Batman's face there. Like, that's the tenor of this world. Like, there's no smiles here.
Yeah, and this is something we'll say about this run in general, right? You very seldom see Bruce Wayne in this run. It's all this. It's always like Batman's already out, already in action, in the shadows.
There's no downtime.
No downtime. You know, drugs, criminals on every corner, a city just falling to pieces, basically, with Batman tirelessly working in the shadows to fight all of this. This drug is called Fever, and it turns people into this, essentially.
They go a bit mad, get a bit power crazy, really aggressive. It's kind of like they couldn't use meth, so they've used this new thing called Fever, and they literally... There's this old night watchman who is coming out to see what's going to happen, because they are going to set a cat on fire, and instead they set him on fire. And that's the starting tone of this entire run.
we've gone from the giant pool table to this in like three issues. I mean, this is really something, isn't it? These are like delinquent kids. Yeah. I mean, he's beating up a teenage girl here, essentially. They've gone mad on fever.
Yeah.
And they killed an old man. Or they've severely hospitalized him. No, he's dead. Yeah.
He's dead. Yeah. Yeah. They burned him alive. So Batman's like, all these kids are on fever. Batman doesn't know what it is, so the policeman's explaining it to him, and it's this new drug and it's going crazy, and they know where it's coming from.
Look, but this, again, pure Breyfogle. Yeah.
But it's so well holed up. They've got so many good defenses. You can see the great big silver doors that every time they bust in there, they've already flushed all the drugs, so they can't do it. And it's all being run by Ventriloquist and Scarface here.
And this is the debut of Ventriloquist and Scarface, who I don't know if he's around that much these days, but for a good run in there, he was a mainstay in the 90s.
He's been made a lot creepier, and I think they've kind of, in this one, it's kind of assumed Batman treats Ventriloquist very much as the mastermind, and the Scarface is just the kind of a facet of his madness. But in the current iteration, I think he is actually the spirit of a mob boss possessing the puppet. So
right,
yeah,
okay.
Kills a load of his own people and threatens this guy called Fat Man or something like that.
Yeah. Just look at the art here. You can just tell what sort of slob this guy is, you know.
Proper piggy. And they give him one last job, but it turns out that it's going to kill him. He's going to kill him anyway. So that's that.
So Ventriloquist and Scarface are basically these drug pushers here. And again, look. All in the shadows, all detective work, all the time.
They don't even draw his mouth in half the shots. Like, if you go up a little bit, like, he's just pure. He's only the cowl at that point.
What it felt like to me reading this is that we'd gone from like reading, I don't know, like a 12 or a PG or something, to like reading like an 18 rated. Comic.
Yeah, you'll notice the distinct lack of Jason Todd as well. There's no Robin. Right.
Isn't he dead?
He's dead now.
Yeah,
so
he's dead,
this is all the darker side has come out. So Batman's beating up these drugs. I love all of this, like the paneling, the rage you can feel, like there's real kind of kinetic energy in every hit. And then you get down to this little bit where there's the one guy left who's trying to get rid of the drugs, and he gives him a swirly. It's just like this, look at the artwork there. You know, he's like, he's flushing him.
Now, would you say, because there's a debate among Batman fans often, especially fans of this era, and you'll see tons of threads online, you know, Norm Breyfogle versus Jim Aparo, who's the better artist. Mm. Now, obviously, for a lot of people, Aparo's Batman is like the classic Batman. That's who they think of when they think of Batman. But for me, I think I'm leaning towards this slightly more stylized motion of the Breyfogle, the shadow and the motion, basically.
This is what I consider to be like early-ish Breyfogle. I don't know whether or not I like what happens to him later on, because he does evolve his style yet further. But this iteration I really like, yeah. Over the Aparo stuff. Yeah, you can see the black now, again, more coming in. So this whole section here, where, just scroll up a little bit. Yeah, he's just getting so angry. I loved all of this. Gave me proper chills. That did.
I mean, this was a properly good debut for Grant and Wagner as well, I thought. Really good. Like, I was like, oh, wow, this run starts with a bang. And of course, this is the introduction of a brand new villain as well. And that's something else that Grant and Wagner do, is they just invent a pile of... So Barr very much was using the classic Rose Gallery, which was fun. But these guys are just inventing their own villains. You know, Ventriloquist and Scarface is brand new. And I want to say, well, there's a few new villains that we'll see. So this is the conclusion of this story. I've noticed, by the way, that Breyfogle often doesn't do the covers. He doesn't do his own covers.
They usually don't, do they? I mean, Aparo didn't do most of his own covers. They usually get guests in.
They're kind of house style, I suppose. Okay, so here's this Fat Man back again. And he's been sent on a mission to do something. But he finds himself knifed. Was that by Scarface? Did Scarface kill him?
So he arranges his death and then they use his corpse to transport the drugs.
Gross. Really gross. So yeah, there's there we have this.
I see Ventriloquist as kind of like a proto penguin in this sense, because he runs this club. That's one of the things. He chucks this guy out of his club. But I think once this run is completed, he's never a club owner again. He moves to kind of just being a member of the criminal underworld, whereas then Penguin takes over the Iceberg Lounge. But yeah, this guy looks funny at him, so they chuck him out.
Yeah, and he's got a bit of kind of Joe Pesci kind of inferiority complex, and he's essentially like the Joe Pesci character from Goodfellas or Casino or any of those sorts of films, which obviously came after this. Maybe Joe Pesci was based on this Scarface character. but yeah, we get you know, Batman confronts them in this club here, rips off Scarface's head,
which keeps talking, interestingly, even though it's sort of on the ground. It's unclear whether or not the mouth's still moving, but it's still talking. And then he picks it up again. Yeah. And he plays
Ventriloquist is quite a sad character, isn't he? Like, he's clearly like schizophrenic. Well,
there's three of him. So, like, there's the original guy, Arnold Wesker, who's the original Ventriloquist. And he is kind of a bit of a sad character. But the other ones, I don't know, like, he's quiet and meek. He always does this. They did try and do a female ventriloquist, I think, afterwards.
Like, he's crying about Fat Man being...
He always was at odds with... he was always at odds with Scarface, really. Basically, his origin story, which... was kind of, I don't know where they put it, but it's explained later. He has a barroom brawl and he kills someone when he finally snaps, basically, from being his meek self, gets sent to Blackgate and gets introduced to the dummy, which was carved from the Blackgate gallows by his cellmate. And then he talks to the dummy, or it's possessed by the spirits around, and he kills his cellmate, which scars the dummy, and that's where he comes from, basically.
There's that fantastic left uppercut that, again, he hit Scarecrow with that earlier on.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he's hit it again. So, yeah, this was a good story. I thought good intro.
Apart from the weird sort of baby voicing of the dummy, which was a bit strange.
He says gack, doesn't he, a lot?
Yeah.
All starts everything with G, and he's back in jail, of course.
Oh yeah. So that top thing there was Batman gets infected with fever, and he was going to kill Ventriloquist and doesn't, because he recognizes the drug, and that's the end of that one, I think.
Yeah, and now we have a truly gross story, which is this thing about the rat catcher or the rat king or whatever his name is.
I enjoyed the art in this one and just the general concept, but it is the grimmest story.
This is so grim. I mean, we're now dropped into this world of complete beggary and look at the state on these people. They've been living. I mean, can you imagine? They've been living down the sewers.
There's four of them, and they've been locked down there for years, and this one guy manages to escape, who we only know as a judge, and they've been there so long that they've gone basically blind, and one of them's gone mad, and then we have this second story alongside to kind of introduce the whole premise, which is Batman going on his nightly crusade.
Yeah.
Juxtaposed with this guy trying to escape, and he's being caught by the rat catcher. Again, this is horrible, but yeah,
it's so grim. There he is, the rat catcher.
He's like, you could, if you took this shot, excluding the Batman stuff, and made it into the opening of a horror film, you wouldn't think twice about it.
This whole story arc was completely gross in all ways. I mean, it was you know, just the world of it, but also just imagining the squalor of living down in those sewers for all those years, and just you'd go mad, wouldn't you? And he starves them and he forces them to eat rats.
Yeah,
it's so gross.
And we've got this thing with Batman fighting these guys whilst this guy desperately tries to get out. He's, you know, he's got his muscles have atrophied. He barely makes it out of the manhole cover. And then just as he thinks he's about to escape, he literally gets eaten alive by the rats.
Oh, it's just gross. It's just unbelievable. The whole story is just...
And Batman doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know that there's this rat catcher villain. He just knows that rats have eaten the man alive. And he's just like, oh, this is unusual. But he doesn't immediately pull a super villain motive. He just sort of sees someone running away from the scene and he goes after him. But Batman very nearly meets his end here. So if we keep going, because Batman comes down into the sewer. He's chasing this guy who he doesn't know much about, and the rat catcher sends his rats after Batman, and Batman's not used to fighting rats, so his batarangs are basically worthless, and the rats there are sacrificing themselves to protect the rat catcher. So he ends up fighting them in the dark, using flares to hurt them, and he gets human refuse, literally gets shit and piss poured all over him and nearly drowned.
I mean, this is it's unbelievable, this story.
Look at that artwork as well, like just horrific.
Just the grossness of it all.
You say, I'm getting the sense you didn't like this one.
Oh, I thought it was good, but it kind of grossed me out. I thought it was, top work, but really disgusting at the same time.
Yeah, like it has some of the best art of this run, and it has some really good scenes.
Also, it reminded me, do you ever see the film Seven, with Kevin Spacey and Brad Pitt? And have you ever seen that film?
Oh, yeah.
That whole idea, you know, what he does to Sloth, that whole idea of somebody just being left to rot is really horrifying to me.
Yeah.
You know, and then the rats on top of it, and then the sewers on top of that.
Yeah.
It really is. It was, you're right, like a horror. This is like a horror story, this whole thing.
It's and almost Batman. I got a similar vibe when Batman locks KG Beast in that room in the sewer when he realizes he can't deal with him. And you know that if he hadn't escaped, the whole point of that was that he left him there to die. It's just horrific.
Feeding this guy rats. I mean, it's just...
And they're complaining that they're only getting one rat tonight, but apparently this is they shouldn't have tried to escape, or the other guy shouldn't have tried to escape, so he's pissed off at them, so they only get one rat, and he hates them with a passion. And Batman's like, I can't leave, even though I've basically, you know, he's got this great big gash on him from where he's been bitten up by rats, and he can't see anything. And he's covered in human excrement. So he's just, he's going a bit crazy. Then the police come down because they worked out that there's a guy who's kidnapped these four people involved in his conviction. So the rat catcher was a criminal who got convicted of murder, and the guy has got out of prison and kidnapped all of the people involved in prosecuting him. And that's why they're down there. And then Batman's basically having to run there with this flaming torch and try and rescue them. But the rat catcher's decided he's going to kill them all anyway. So he kills the first guy who's gone mad. And then Batman arrives just in time to rescue the other two. Because he's killed enough rats that rat catcher can't call on them for aid, but otherwise would have been there. And then he just comes out like, evening, Jim. As if he hasn't had the most horrific experience of his life, and he's like, I'm not going to deal with this other rat. He's a bit scarred from his experience mentally.
So that's two story arcs, two new villains, Ventriloquist and Scarface and the Rat Catcher. I don't know if the Rat Catcher ever comes back, but it's pretty good.
Do either of them ever match up to the mime, though? That's the question.
Well, Yeah, I would rank them both above the mime, to be honest.
yes, I would too.
And then this is a Breyfogle cover, you can tell that one. Mm-hmm. And then, this was a weird story, wasn't it? With the DJ all the way through it. Yes.
DJ Dark putting out the call to all you Nightcrawlers. Oh, shut up.
It went on forever, this DJ Dark business. But look at the world of this. People are just like, you know, you've got the burning bins. Have you ever seen that film, They Live, Roddy Piper? They loved a burning trash can in the late 80s, didn't they?
It was everything. Yeah.
So
there are homeless camps everywhere. There are youths just sort of hanging around waiting to beat people up. There's kids like who are 9 years old taking this fever drug.
It's just a horrific world, isn't it?
You wouldn't want to live there, would you? You know, it's just Batman is clearly making very little impact on this. Yes, some murders are going on. I can't really remember what really happens in this story. It's quite forgettable.
That DJ is in it all the way through, though, isn't he?
Yeah.
Isn't it this weird phosphorus man who comes like the?
Oh, the he's called was it? I don't know. I know how they beat him, but I can't remember his name. But he's basically made of radiation.
This guy gets like radiated, and then he turns into this weird glowing kind of ghost character. Isn't it?
Yeah, who can?
Here you go.
Hazardous waste, and he becomes, this sort of thing which can reach through walls because he's so corrosive. Corrosive man.
And
I think whilst he's a fucking, whilst it's all fairly forgettable, aside from some good art shots as usual, as we've come to expect. They beat him using quicklime, don't they? And he dies.
Yeah, I think so. Tragic, really tragic character as well, because he doesn't know what's happening to him. Everything he touches kind of disintegrates, and he's really tragic, this guy. I felt sorry for him, actually.
In a strange sense, you wonder whether or not he can ever actually go to sleep. Because, like, where can he lie down where he won't just dissolve into the earth and not ever be able to get out of the hole that he's made for himself?
Really sad. Look at that. Cool. this was a kind of, you know, the story type thing. This guy was involved. This strange kind of guy who dresses up in different characters, this actor.
Yeah.
He plays the Phantom of the Opera, but then he gets changed a few times. I didn't really get this. Like, this corrosive man wants to go after the kind of villain actor, if I can remember correctly.
He blames him for what he's become, but I can't remember why.
Yeah, and then there's the DJ all the way through it. So look at the world.
It's horrific, isn't it?
Look. People are just drinking in absolute dregs here. So
this is the world that the Britisher wants.
Yeah. Does it carry on?
It's quite long. And this is the last one, I think, the Burning Pit, because they basically find a pit of quicklime. And he gets trapped in it, and they're not sure if he's dead or not, but he's been neutralized.
There's this actor again who keeps on just dressing up as various different
playing Faust or something.
But he gets his comeuppance, and the corrosive man gets thrown into some lime, as we mentioned. I mean, this to me, after two very hot stories, was a little bit of a come down.
Yeah.
They're still like the general quality of the art and the world and the grimness of the tone, you know.
And you can respect them for trying to do something. Look, Batman's now almost entirely black. This is something which really continues. And his chest emblem is a lot more prolific. But they just.
What do you think about the Batmobile? I know you like.
It's become a very strange. I like the fact that they've. It's got covers over the tires, which go all the way to the ground now, almost like the car's been flattened. Yeah.
Call it poetic justice. Wow. I'd like to think that this version of Batman, the Grant Breyfogle one, is basically a fascist, isn't he? Let's be honest. He doesn't care anymore. Jason Todd is dead, and he's just kind of this strange skulking figure in the night. We'll skip over this bonus story. We don't need to look at that. And then there was we might as well finish up now that we're here very quickly. Hold on. We might as well finish this up. So this is number three. Now we won't bother looking at the Blind Justice. I think we could skip Blind Justice unless you had any particular thoughts on that story arc. I think that was available as a trade paperback in and of itself. I didn't think much of it, the Sam Hamm story. But we can just finish up on the Grant, on the Wagner Grant stuff. So we had this story involving Abraham Lincoln called The Fear. Any memories of this?
Nothing which is that memorable, if I'm honest.
No, I think we could probably, I think we've established basically
the switch in tone. I do like the new Batmobile there.
Look, more
homeless people. I know it's all old as well. It's like none of these people. It's horrific.
Such a grim world. And of course the Dark Knight detective. This is why it's called it. So what I thought we'd do just to wrap up is to compare now. We've seen four major teams, I would say. Max Allan Collins and with various artists, let's say. Stalin Aparo. Mike Barr with let's say Alan Davis as the main artist, but there are a few different artists involved. But and then we've got this team up of Grant, Wagner, and Breyfogle. My honest view is that this stuff here in Detective Comics, despite the fact that Death in the Family is more famous, and despite the fact that the Max Allan Collins stuff is, because it's the origin story of Jason Todd, is arguably more famous and mainstream as well. I think this run that we're looking at here, the Grant, Wagner, Breyfogle run, is by far the best thing that we looked at. The best single issue was the showdown between Nightwing and Batman. Batman? Can't remember the exact. Was it 416? Batman 416. That was probably the best.
Remember the numbers.
I think Batman 416 was the best single issue. But in terms of the run, I think this run is better than the
overall run. Overall, I prefer this run. I do think the look at that face. I do think that the for me the it's the two issue new origin of Batman, I think, was done very, very well. That's my personal favorite, and I do like the Fever one. In terms of like that, I think that's got a good amount of heft and emotional payoff to it.
One of the things I would say about these stories, as compared with the Stalin Aparo ones, I felt that the Stalin Aparo ones dragged at times, like really dragged. The KGB beast stuff, but even in the middle of Death in the Family, all that stuff like back and forth in Middle East and the Ayatollah, and it was fun, but I felt there were periods of it that just felt a bit kind of just boring. whereas I'm never really that bored in this world, because it's just so grim, everything. And the, if nothing else, the Breyfogle art has got so much kind of motion and shadows and stuff in it that, you know.
Yeah, I think that they've done really well. Stalin and Apero really fell into a kind of routine, especially with the fights. There was always a panel with Batman dodging something. Then another scene where he gets like one good punch off, but it was all fairly formulaic, I felt, whereas I feel like there's been a more variety in both the settings and the use of set pieces as part of the flow of the scene, I would say, rather than just general whacking them. That sort of thing. You'll notice things like in the earlier stuff where Jason Todd's still around, he's vaulting cars and stuff like that. Whereas you would typically in a Stalin Apero shot, the scenery would be absent, but you'd get a load of kind of after image shots of Batman twirling around, for instance. But you wouldn't get much interaction.
I'll be honest, I prefer the Mike Barr run to the Stalin Apero as well. I thought the Mike Barr run was super fun in and of itself. I mean, it's a bit dislocated from everything else going on, but it was good.
Yeah. Dude, fuck Apero. Like, no, I'm joking.
I honestly think I'd rank them, you know, Grant Wagner, then Barr, then Apero, and then Max Allen Collins last. I think that's fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you go the same order?
I go the same route for me, yeah, definitely.
So you'd rate Barr above Apero?
I'd rate Barr above Apero. You can see there's more of a...
Stalin,
yeah, Apero. Above Stalin Apero. I think there's more of a... Especially when it comes to the... if we're talking just about the artwork, I feel like they... Obviously, Stalin Apero had a real kind of... There's a certain, you can tell immediately when you're reading a Stalin Apero story. You know, they've got good chemistry together. But I think almost because of the nature of the times where Barr and Breyfogle have to basically adapt and change, and you can see the change in tone, and you can see the change in settings, and you can see the change in the way that everything's drawn and the coloration and the inking as well, that it's more fun for the eye. So,
So overall, even though I was saying at the start, you know, the Detective Comics is the B show, if you want to put it that way. I thought throughout this era, Detective Comics was probably the stronger book.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
And possibly because there's less of a need to try to tie everything back to some overarching story. They're very much kind of self-contained, you know, two or three issue story arcs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just more fun, if nothing else. There we go. So I don't know what people in the chat think, if anybody's read these themselves. How would people, just with a show of numbers, I guess we'll just put it between Apero and Grant Wagner. Where would people go based on what you've seen, or if you're already fans? So maybe what we'll do is Detective Comics versus Batman. If you think the main book was better at this time, press one. And if you think Detective Comics was better in the, if you think Detective Comics was better, press two, and we'll see
how things turn out.
Yeah, maybe nobody knows. Maybe we're just introducing people to these things. So have a look. We've got a vote for Grant Wagner. So there we go.
That's it. Twos and a half. So
they mainly agree with us.
Yeah.
All right.
And so they should.
It's 6 o'clock, so we should probably get going. My tea has long gone cold. I didn't quite finish it. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back again for some cultural or art topic. I think maybe next time I'm going to do a music guide. I was thinking of running through the obscure 70s act, the Residents' back catalogue, because they're a very strange group. But I put it out for a Twitter poll, and they came rock bottom because nobody's ever heard of them. And the people have chosen the Wu-Tang Clan. But as people know, I often completely ignore
what people ignore
polls, yeah, because democracy sucks. All right. Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you very much, everyone. See you again.
It's been a pleasure.